This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rustan, today we have the return of one of the founding fathers of A Bit of Culture, Sharad Kooten.
Always a pleasure to be here, Cam.
A pleasure to have you here. And we have a first-timer for A Bit of Culture, but journalist and broadcaster, Carla Sapsford-Newman.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you here. And also, you might be able to tell from the sound of her voice that she is a card-carrying member of America Land, who I believe is going to the polls to vote on the day that we will be first broadcasting this show.
In fact, you could have casted your vote. I didn't just mail it in.
I couriered it to make sure it wouldn't be lost or rigged.
And where, by the way, are
Florida.
You?
Florida.
Oh.
So I'm swinging.
All right.
My state is swinging.
You're important.
As we speak.
Yeah.
Yes. Very good.
Hillary Clinton keeps visiting my mother's hometown.
And today you're wearing blue, so I don't know if we can draw any conclusions from that.
You can, right. But we'll get to that.
Okay. So our three topics this week. Topic number one is the leader of the free world. Topic number two, false equivalence. And finally, topic number three will be anti-intellectualism in American culture and politics. So, Sharad, America's going to the polls, and they are going to be voting for the leader of the free world, are they not?
That's apparently the title that's going to be given. I think it's the words written across the crown of this, or it's on the scepter that's handed to the winner of that race. And so we're either going to have a President Donald Trump, or you're going to have a President Hillary Rodham?
No, she's given up the middle name.
Has she?
Yeah, she's given it up.
I thought she did that too, out of respect for her mother. So anyway, so then it's, you know, Hillary Clinton, which means we'll have yet another President Clinton. I don't know which sounds better, but both of them, either of them, will become leader of the free world. And I'm interested in the expression because, partly because of my interest in the Cold War, and since, you know, and it was really, I think, salient to talk about the free world, perhaps at that time, you know, divided as it were between the First World and the Second, with the Third World being that area for proxy wars between the First and the Second. Second being, of course, the Communist bloc. Yeah. But really, what does it mean today? What does it mean to talk about the leader of the free world in view of, you know, so much that we understand about how superpower politics works?
Well, I mean, obviously, I take from what you're saying that you recognize the legitimacy of the American president as the leader of the free world, and
I mean the leader of the free world is just an expression.
Okay,
I mean you could put it above, you know, a fast food joint, right, and that'd be fine too. But you know what I'm saying is that, you know, and it really did have some resonance for people, didn't it? I mean, the idea that Americans must believe that they lead the free world.
Well, I think that's the governing myth that we've lived under for, you know, ever since the Second World War. So
I'm glad you said that, not me.
Yes. So, I mean, there's several assumptive aspects of that. One is the world free. Is there a free world really anywhere? Two, does it want to be led? And three, is there a leader anymore in this, you know, world of social media and fragmentation and globalization, etc.? I think it's a very outdated term, and it's interesting. I hear it more outside the U.S. than I hear it inside.
Really?
Yes. So I think in that sense, it's just not a reference we I think make that much anymore.
Yeah, I hear it in American political commentary a fair bit. You know,
right wing or left wing?
I don't know, left of center, neutral media circles. So when, for instance, Donald Trump says something really inane and incredibly stupid, the commentators will say, look, we're voting for the man who will be the leader, man or woman who will be the leader of the free world. Can we honestly vote for this moron?
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, Carla's right in this respect. I think people outside America assume that the American president is an all-powerful position. Whereas I think perhaps in America, Americans are much more aware that, you know, their government is made up of competing institutions, the presidency being one, and then, of course, there's Congress, and then, of course, you have the judiciary. And I think all those things make American politics, but from the outside, we just see the projection of power and often embodied by the American president. I think, you know, if there was anybody responsible for resurrecting this idea of the leader of the free world, it would be Obama, because he came on a crest of optimism that somebody would provide leadership on a global stage with all these progressive values, because he's gone on to, you know, trample most of them. But it doesn't really matter, right? Because
but he ended up pulling back American
absolutely.
Presence in most areas of the world, including Asia, which he had promised to pivot to. And so in that sense, there's a sense of disillusionment, I think, not only in the U.S., but in Asia and the rest of the world as to how much the U.S. can actually accomplish and support these ideals that we espouse so eloquently.
But Carla, I should have pointed out earlier that you've been living outside of America for a long time and living in Malaysia for
6 years.
Are you suggesting she's gone native? Are you suggesting?
Well, no, but you know, when you are away from somewhere, it does. True. It you know, you can lose touch. But one of the things that say the Trump supporters, well, they wear on their heads, is "Make America Great Again." That if there was a time when it was said more trippingly off the tongue, "Leader of the Free World," not so much now, then it must be a sense that America is not as great, inside America, that is not as great as it once was, and that's a problem.
Well, you know, this is, you know, that famous speech that's given by that character in a newsroom broadcast, I mean, on a television series. I watched it on the flight to the U.S.
Oh, yes. Question is asked, what is it that you think is great about America?
America. And then he goes on and he rattles off this whole thing. Okay, we've talked about this before, but just coming back to the question of what Obama does to this idea, right, of the leader of the free world. I do think that leadership is not a bad thing, and you do want, but then America's record, I think, with regard to this is, and we're now under the, you know, there's a big conspiracy in the air, right? The whole, we resurrected that George Soros script that was thrown out, I think, in the late 90s, or written in the late 90s. It's now back again.
He's back, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And again, there's this.
He's causing trouble for us, isn't he?
Yeah, specter of regime change is in the air again.
He's Jewish.
Hungarian, yeah. American. And more importantly, I think it does remind us that leadership also can mean the imposition of your will, of values, right?
Yes, but also, I mean, historically, if you look at how the U.S. has been demonized and seen as a neocolonial power, well, in a sense, we've pulled back from that as well. And yet there's still this sense of looking to the U.S. for leadership.
Protection.
And
protection.
I think this is what annoys America. It's like, you want us to lead, you want us to pay for everything, and then you give us a tight slap in the face. Yeah. But actually, look, hold on. Ukraine. They did fund civil society groups in the Ukraine against the administration before,
yeah,
that,
yeah,
they didn't like. So, I mean, America plays differently in different parts of the world.
Obviously it does. But can I ask you, Carla, when you were growing up in America, did you... Were you inculcated? Were the words ever said to you that, you know, America is this beacon, this city on the hill, that the world turns to?
Well, of course, that was the Reagan doctrine, and also historically going back to the 19th century, there's this this sense of manifest destiny, that we have this specialness about us that means we must conquer new territories and convert the world to this democratic, egalitarian ideal that we all aspire to. And of course, throughout our history, we've not always lived up to that. But there is a sense that we carry some kind of moral authority that no one else can really.
So when you then went out of America for the first time, were you expecting, as an American, or to see America be considered in a particular way, and were surprised otherwise?
Well, it depends on where you go. I mean, initially I went to Europe, which at that time in the 80s was fairly pro-American, and so I think sentiment worldwide has changed about the role of the U.S., and I think sentiment has changed inside the U.S. about the role of the U.S., and we have a long history of xenophobia and closing our borders and building walls, and everything that we're hearing now is nothing new. We go through these waves of pro and anti-immigration, pro and anti-integration, pro and anti intervention overseas. And so what we're seeing is just we go through one of these extreme
these
swings.
Pendulum swings, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it comes back to the question of the free will. I mean, is it valuable to talk about it, whether you invested in an individual or an institution or a country or in something like civil society, global civil society?
I'd say we shouldn't worry, because pretty soon Vladimir Putin will be the leader of the... whatever it is.
Oh, no, sorry, you're wrong. It's Xi Jinping.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, he'll be the chief financier, but Putin will be the...
There'll be an alliance of strongmen.
So anyway, we must move on, though, to topic number two, which is something which has been coming up a lot in the course of the debates over the American presidency and journalism, which is false equivalence. It's the notion that both sides are equally good or equally bad, or that both sides must be given an opportunity to speak, so that in a political system like America or indeed Malaysia, where you have essentially two sides, only two sides competing for power, both sides must be given a voice. So,
well, actually, isn't that not exactly correct? I mean, there are four teams, as it were, fighting this presidential election, right? The Libertarians as well as the Green Party. Oh. And I just read a piece making the argument.
It's like David and Goliath. But yeah, they're fighting the good fight.
No, the question is, you know, some polls reflect it. So they will say, you know, if you have this as a four-way contest, this is what the numbers look like. If you drop the two smaller parties, this is what the numbers would look like. The fact that American television and you know, the trust that puts together the presidential debates ignores, you know, the Green Party and Jill Stein.
Yeah,
and
but it, sure, it is what it is. I mean, both the Libertarian and the Green Party combined are getting like 5% of the...
Except in Utah.
Yeah.
In the Mormon candidate. Where
the Mormon candidate. So you have essentially, Sherrod, I think we can both agree, that you have essentially two candidates who are vying for the presidency.
Although you could say Bernie Sanders, if this had been any other country, could have been a third-party candidate.
If America had proportional representation, we're willing to go for Bernie Sanders. But anyway, they don't. Okay. I want to talk about false equivalency. Okay. I don't want to talk about the lack of whatever it is you want to talk about.
I was going to talk about false equivalency.
Oh, well, great.
Okay, so another example would be, and I don't think the American example is the best one, but I think it said to me that when you bring on a panel in front of television cameras people who believe that climate change is happening, scientists, for instance, and you bring a scientist representing the climate change deniers, then actually you're engaging in some form of false equivalence. Because what's happening is that you're taking somebody who represents almost 99% of the scientific community and somebody who's representing less than 1% of the scientific community. So, and you're making it sound like they're both equally compelling arguments with equally compelling facts and scientific data to back those positions. So that, I'm told, is an instance of false equivalence in the media on the question of climate change.
Okay, can I bring that back to the election? So CNN has gotten a lot of heat for getting Corey Lewandowski and all of these Trump people who are still on the Trump payroll and who are essentially pundits. And so to be CNN pundits. And so essentially you have people from the campaign to essentially balance out all of the numerous left-wing and liberal and Democratic pundits that they normally have, just because CNN was not in the business of putting alt-right people on their panels. And so they come under a lot of criticism because they pull out these campaign people who, you know, are equivalent to people who've been in the arena for 20, 30 years and who actually have some credentials. Mm. So there's a sort of a debate going on as to how much weight you're supposed to give each side.
Well, I want to follow on from that and expand upon it. So you have one side who are saying something which is demonstrably wrong, which is factually incorrect, where they're actually lying. They're saying that their candidate did not say something which he clearly did. Now, the in the case of CNN and the broadcast media, I want to ask you both as journalists, they don't see themselves as being the people who should step in and say, that is false. They leave it to one of the candidates to come forward.
Or PolitiFact.
PolitiFact. Yeah. And then essentially they're then saying to the audience, and then we'll let you decide. And I'm wondering, as journalists, when you find yourself in this situation, what do you do? Do you step in and...
I've never moderated a presidential debate.
No, but it's not even that. I mean, it's just politics in general.
I understand.
If they say something which is clearly factually wrong...
I think that the example would be like when talking about any kind of social phenomena, whether the things you're comparing are equal, like the apples, you know, and apples you're comparing. A local example would be maybe Berset and the red shirts, you know. Mm. And I think sometimes they get put into the same box as if they're the same sort of phenomena. In fact, they're serious asymmetries because, I think with the red shirts, you see them backed by this, you know, indirectly by the state, whereas, you know, Berset really is a civil society phenomenon. I mean, that's one argument you can make. And in some sense, what they stand for also is so different, right? And so what is it that we compare them in terms of, government action or police action in particular. So I think that's what you mean by a false equivalence, right? You're putting things that really can't be compared on the same plane.
Well, but there's also the sheer entertainment value and what the audience wants. And so the media is always trying to do this, you know, dance with how much it's like broccoli versus chocolate. How much broccoli are we supposed to give our listeners or viewers or readers versus the chocolate that they want? Because whenever you put Trump on TV or radio, ratings go up, and it's a big business, and
balance,
we'd like to be entertained.
Yeah, but balance is another great kind of journalistic myth, right? So the idea is that you and pitting people together, like, you know, so you have somebody who's supposedly left wing, somebody who's right wing, you put them all together, you know, and they just shout at each other.
Well, I think, just to wrap up, if I may, I think one of the legacies that were of this false equivalence is that people walk away being cynical. But cynical in a kind of like faux cool way, which is like, they're just all equally bad. But really, you actually have to make a choice. The other is, though, the growth of the thing. Well, that's just your opinion. Climate change, that's just your opinion. Gravity, well, that's just your opinion.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of skepticism around experts. I think that's what it is. Too many experts or people feeling emboldened by, you know, their ability to Google or Wikipedia their way towards knowledge, you know.
But also I think people feel talked down to by these pundits, and like they're being patronized, and, you know, their own ideas or opinions are being diminished by some Ivy League, elite from the East Coast or Kuala Lumpur or wherever they are, the capital.
That leads us on very nicely to what we will be talking about in a moment, which is anti-intellectualism. Hey, that's me, brothers and sisters. Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9.
5-Hour Tea with caffeine from green tea leaves. It's delicious, energizing, and comes in 3 amazing flavors. With 0 sugar and 4 calories, it fits your life. With its compact size and portability, it goes where you go. To the campsite, the hiking trail, the beach, without weighing you down. 5-Hour Tea. Caffeine from green tea leaves. Release your natural side. From the makers of 5-Hour Energy. For more information, visit 5hourenergy.com. Try 5-Hour Tea today. Look for 5-Hour Tea at your local Circle K store.
And we're back with myself, Cam Raslan, Sherrod Kooten, and Carla Sapsford-Newman. Did I say that right?
Yes.
Good. Good. So we're going to discuss anti-intellectualism in American culture and politics, and indeed in the world. Carla.
Well, as I was just saying, I think there's a backlash against this whole East Coast, West Coast thing in the States, where people feel like they're talked down to, and the only people you ever hear about are from, you know, the main political parties and the think tanks, etc. And it doesn't reflect the way that most real people actually think or believe, and so this whole beltway mentality, there's definitely something to it. And the reason the pundits were 90% of them wrong is because they weren't in Akron, Ohio regularly, or they weren't, you know, bagging groceries at the local grocery store, or, you know, doing, you know, blue collar jobs with blue collar people. And so it's a very valid, you know, complaint, is that in the media, if you look at it, it's middle or upper middle class white people generally who decide what's news, what's newsworthy.
But hasn't it always been so?
It's always been so.
Back in the mid-19th century, there was a political movement in America called the Know-Nothings, who were Trump before Trump. They were nativist, anti-intellectual.
There have been many iterations of this. And so, yes, and so they come on the scene, they make a big storm, and they get a lot of attention, and then sooner or later, things trickle back to a certain new normal. And so in that sense, that's, I think, what we're getting here. But I think if you really want more diverse opinions in the media, you need to have more diverse people in the media. And that's not
including
something,
the Know-Nothings.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you could have political anthropologists whose responsibility is, in fact, to kind of ground their analysis.
Well, but that would be considered intellectual.
Yes, straight elitism.
Away, Sherrod. Well, this is Ivory Tower. Yeah.
So you
blah,
can't have
blah,
both
blah.
Ways.
You lost me. You lost me at we could have political anthropologists.
Well, okay.
Sorry.
I think that was there's an animal in the studio.
Yeah.
Okay. There's also this question of anti-intellectualism in other kinds of fields of endeavor, including things like art. So I'm thinking of the way in which in some countries, there's a really there's a premium placed on grounding your art practice in theoretical insights that come from philosophy or, you know, social theory or whatever. And there's a vocabulary that comes with it. And then there's...
That no one understands.
Well, no, some people understand it, obviously. And maybe it's limited, but I think that's just a function of whether you're interested in communicating. And, you know, and some artists are very good. I mean, they could have be very strong intellectually and conceptually and yet be really good communicators. I don't think the philosophy of the social theory prevents you from that. And then there are others who just resist it because they think, oh, it's all fashionable and it's just about the everybody, you know, dropping the word Lacan, you know. Okay, I know I'm from night school, but, you know, but still, you know. And I think that... And that's another kind of block. And, you know, we refuse to see that we can refine our tools use a vocabulary that's not adequate to the situation.
I think it's not really about us anymore. And we're all, you know, overeducated and fairly. We represent whatever elite that, you know, where we come from, wherever that is. And I think... what they have found in this election is a sense, you know, back in Watergate days, you know, the president or whoever only had to make 3 phone calls to 3 networks and they could kill any story permanently. And now everyone is going to their own source of information that they feel reflects their values, opinions, and worldview. And so in a sense, it's the media has become largely irrelevant for issues relating, I think, to the anti-intellectualism, where they're saying, don't talk down to me. I'm going to go to this Glenn Beck, or I'm going to go to whoever radio talk show host Rush Limbaugh. I'm going to go to Fox News and get the news that I want. I'm not going to, you know, waste my time with people. Who don't understand me or don't speak my language. And so, in that sense, we've got a. And what Trump has done is cut through a lot of that mainstream jargon and reached, in, you know, what some have called a dog whistle politics. He's reached his core base, which are white working class, usually male voters, in a language that they can understand. Unfortunately, it also talks to the racist and white supremacists and all of that. But he's cut through all of that noise because people now know, with, you know, so much access to information, they know where to go.
Yeah. But also the word authentic comes to mind, especially with what you were saying just now, Shraddha.
So that intellectuals are inauthentic.
Well, no, it's not that they are necessarily inauthentic, but a person needs to be perceived as being authentic in order to be a valid voice.
Yeah, so Trump would say something like, you know, they're bad men. I mean, you know, it's like his analysis, you know, kind of starts and ends there.
Yeah, but also, though, that is the authentic voice of people who are at home watching Fox News, say, and shouting at the TV.
But it's an authentic emotional voice. Yeah. And I think where intellectuals fall short in terms of connecting is because they're in their head and they don't engage with the heart.
Yeah, well, not, I mean, some can. I think that Bill Clinton was very, very good at that. I think that if we go further back, say, Abraham Lincoln was very good at that.
Well, I mean, I think this is it, right? So understanding sentiment, and I think sentiment has been, and sentiment drives the markets. I mean, you know, stock markets. I think there's a very famous book, a collection of essays called Habits of the Heart by Robert Bella, where he, you know, where, you know, social scientists try to understand this level of social dynamics that really shape the world, right? It's not, like you say, it's not all in your head. It's not all intellected. A lot of it is felt. There's a lot of emoting going on. And you're right. If people don't understand that, you know, just because Trump says something that's sexist and misogynistic doesn't mean, and you as somebody who's, you know, kind of like against that, doesn't mean that the people on the ground necessarily feel that way. I mean, enough evidence to show that they could just completely disregard that.
But also, if we tie in Malaysia here for a moment, I don't think we necessarily talk about anti-intellectualism in Malaysia. It's not necessarily an epithet that's thrown around very much, because with America,
we're almost all in anti-intellectual.
Well, maybe, I don't know, because America, it perhaps has an unfair standard to live by, which is it's supposed to be the richest country in the world, and so you would assume that it's going to be a highly educated populace. But surprise, surprise, they're not particularly. Whereas if you go to countries outside where there is no expectation that the education level is going to be particularly high, people don't talk about anti-intellectualism.
I mean, look, honestly, I mean, we could talk about America, but, you know, let's think about the European tradition, intellectual scholars becoming public intellectuals. This is very important, right? But in a place like America, the premium might not be. You know, I think from the early days, and Alexis de Tocqueville, you know, Democracy in America lays out very clearly what the democratic impulse is. The democratic impulse doesn't result in the creation of, you know, an acute intellectual sense. And, you know, what it does is to say everybody has the right to, and in fact, there's a kind of leveling down. And this is what de Tocqueville was very, you know, very concerned about as a European viewing this new phenomenon called democracy. I think he was slightly suspicious of it. He knew it was an inexorable force, but, you know, he was also deeply suspicious. Did I drop enough names there to demonstrate my intellectualism? Robert Bella, Alexis de Tocqueville.
I'm numb.
Okay.
No, but, I mean, I've heard the same debate, for instance, about the American or British system of having trials, right, and having a jury. And so Europeans always, you know, held up their nose and say, how could a bunch of rabble and bus drivers and school teachers be able to, you know, make legalistic judgments about the merits of a case? And it's very much in our tradition, going back to the British, where we want representation from the people. And so it's an ideal that we've always held up as one of the standards of justice and democracy. But of course, it's been gamed.
But remember, even in the trial situation, the judge instructs the jury. The judge doesn't let the jury just go off on its own. It instructs the jury on the legal merits, on the framework. So the rabble is in some ways corralled into. But decision. I agree with you completely. The sentiment that ordinary people have a right to judge and they have the good sense to judge, it differs from country to country, and I would rather a democratic system than one that isn't.
But it's very messy.
Yeah. Well, I just want to end with one thing, which is that Carla, you went to Columbia University.
Yes.
Yep. So you're an intellectual.
Yes.
Damn you. And Sharad here, NUS, National University of Singapore, right?
Because I think the Asian equivalent.
Yeah. Oh, and no. I went to Wellesley undergraduate, which is
just laying it thick
now. Yeah.
She
didn't
No. That's where Hillary Clinton went.
All
and
right.
Women's college, is it? Liberal arts college.
Yes, right? Which she never talks about, which is quite interesting.
All right. So the thing is, though, so you the a lot of people out there in internet land, they would say that you people have merely been indoctrinated into the globalist agenda, which is run by the likes of the Rothschild family for the New World Order. So these people would believe that you may think you know something, but you're just indoctrinated sheep, whereas they are actually the true intellectuals, the new intellectuals, because they know the actual truth of the way that the world is run. Or so they would think.
Well, there's something to that.
Yeah.
Well,
and then, as Carla said, people retreat further and further into these smaller and smaller circles of their own echo chambers. They just assume that you are just indoctrinated people who believe that 9/11 was not an inside job.
Well, maybe. I mean, but, you know, I'd like to drop another name here. Antonio Gramsci, you know, and his concept of the organic intellectual. I mean, you know, just because you're poor or uneducated, what doesn't mean you're stupid? I mean, being an intellectual means being able to articulate a coherent view of the world. What Trump is peddling is actually a very incoherent, fragmented, slightly illogical view of the world. I mean, the only thing that ties it together is this grand conspiracy. That's the only thing that really holds all these factoids.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But
whether he calls it Crooked Hillary or whatever, you know.
Okay. But to wrap that up, but Hillary, she spouts policy, and she thinks that just by talking about policy that she can connect to people about things they care about. But there's no... people don't perceive there's authentic emotion there. They don't get the real warm, cuddly person they can relate to.
Yeah.
So there's so her content is much more coherent, but she's still not connecting.
Mm. Well, by the time, folks, you listen to this, you may know in future time whether we live under El Presidente Donald Trump and the world has become a darker place, or if Hillary Clinton won.
President,
the first female president. But we don't know right now. But we're now going to move on to the final part of our show, recommendations. We recommend something we think might be of interest. And in a change to the regular schedule, I'm going to go first. And my recommendation is that a while back, Sharad came here and he told us about the Mulu Caves. He'd been to Mulu in Sarawak. And since then, I've been there and I want to recommend it. I think it's just the most amazing place where you actually experience... you can go to the caves, Deer Cave, and experience size and come to an understanding of what scale really is.
And geological time.
Yeah, yeah. And it's very, it's quite moving. And it's, you cannot photograph it. It's wonderful when you go to somewhere that cannot be photographed because it's just too big. No photograph could do it justice. Carla, have you been?
No, I'm not. I have two small children.
You have two small children. So yeah.
Strapping them to my back and going trekking somehow.
And you would have to offer them as to the slave to the cave gods. You know?
No, actually, it's very doable. I mean, it's actually
with
very
kids?
Family orientated. With the
kids?
Broadwalk, everything make it friendly to children. I mean, you just have to take.
You got to carry them, all right? But I think I wait till they're wait till they're a bit.
Well, after 5 minutes, they say carry me. So
yeah.
And it's hot. 22 kilos.
So maybe if you have young children, maybe not. If you're not really very quite able-bodied, Sharad, I'd say it could be quite.
Are you implying that Sharad is not able?
No, I'm asking his experience because he went. But it's in Malaysia. I do believe Sarawak is part of Malaysia still.
Is?
Okay, good.
Until the end of November.
All right. So if you're a West Malaysian, you just need to take your IC, and you can't work there, obviously. But go check it out; it's fantastic. So, Mulu Caves, Sarawak. Sharad, what's
okay? I mentioned two books already. So, Robert Bella's Habits of the Heart, but there's also Christopher Lash, I think, and his work, which as a American cultural critic, really helps. You understand some of the impulses in sort of cultural change there. But I really think the classic is Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, which I studied in school, in university. And my teacher, Chang Cheng Tung, who's Taiwanese, American-trained Taiwanese sociologist, who really took pains to get us to understand this book. And it's a powerful critique of democracy from somebody who at that time in history had no sense. Oh, he had a sense that democracy was going to be big in the world, but it hadn't become. And so we now take democracy as the kind of default mode for government. I think his sense of people, his sense of the impulses, just extraordinary. It's an amazing French scholar.
He wrote about America when he visited there in the year... Anyone?
1750?
No, it was later.
Later. I think it was early part of the
19th century. I think it was the 1820s or so. And he wrote a book.
Well, I don't remember the date. We can look it up. But I mean, the
point was it was basically what he did on his holidays. It was that kind of book.
Well, no, I mean, he went...
What else did he ever write?
Yeah, he went on to explore...
one album.
Yeah, he's a one-hit wonder. But it's an amazing book. And I think if you are interested in democracy, even as a supporter of democracy, it's worth reading this, what has been called an aristocratic critique of democracy.
You read it, Carla? You should.
No.
You're supposed to, haven't you?
It's required reading. I'm an intellectual.
It's very dangerous reading in America, you know, because it's about you people.
Okay. Right. Can I move to my?
Yes, please.
Recommend
yes.
It is a book called White Trash, and it explains a lot about what we're going through, and essentially and how intellectuals have demonized the underclass for centuries. And it was sort of highlighted earlier this year when I think one of the New Yorker writers, I forget his name, basically trashed the white trash who were supporting Trump, these basket of deplorables and all of that. And so it explains that phenomena of why we look down on what we consider to be white trash.
Nonfiction, obviously.
Yes, nonfiction.
And it's by?
By Nancy Eisenberg. And it's about the 400-year-old history of class in America.
Ah.
So it's light reading for anyone who is...
Yeah.
But she does make it entertaining, actually, about how America looks at class and about how we're both obsessed by it and yet we are class deniers extraordinaire. And basically everyone thinks that they are middle class when it's so obvious that
whatever the anti-intellectualism in America, they're... book production and their literary production is enormous.
By the intellectual elites.
Yeah. It doesn't matter, because the intellectual elites are also probing precisely these matters, asking tough questions, being self-reflective, potentially upturning their own worldview.
Writing books that few people read.
Does it matter?
So they should send an army of social anthropologists out there to
political
anthropologists to go out there and beat the hell out of them with baseball bats. Is that right?
Absolutely.
That's the answer.
And can I quickly recommend two series? I'd like to recommend one movie, one series.
Oh gosh, okay. Americans think they can have more than anyone else. Go ahead,
yes,
go on.
Yes,
American exceptionalism.
American exceptionalism.
More is more. Mr. Robot series about essentially fight the power. And about the power of hackers, mm-hmm. but it's very relevant in terms of people wanting to overthrow the system, and to the movie Our Brand is Crisis. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, good fun that with Sandra Bullock. Yep. So that brings us to the end of this week's show. The election will be happening very soon. We may at some future date return and just have a look at the ashes of the destruction that's been left behind. But it only reminds me now to thank our special honored guest, Carla Sapsford-Newman.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
And Sherrod Kooten.
Always a pleasure, Cam.
All right. And myself, Cam Rustlan. You can get in touch with us. I can get in touch with A Bit of Culture on our Facebook page. Like it, and I won't shoot this puppy. And also Twitter feeds. Sherrod's a big Twitter man.
At Sherrod Kooten. Right. But even as Twitter kind of falls apart and is in the complete mess and lays off 9% of its global workforce, yes,
yeah, you're still
at
there.
Sherrod Kooten.
True believer. Carla, are you social media?
No,
at all?
I'm anti.
No? Okay.
Sorry.
All right. So
I have nothing. I don't want to share what I ate for breakfast. I'm sorry. All right. And I have no deep thoughts. So, nobody wants to.
Well, you're
see
really going for
kids.
This, like, I am an anti intellectual, aren't you?
I'm
just a woman of the people. Yeah. And yet you don't deny that you went to Wesley, unlike Hillary. And then there's myself, Cam Rustlan. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Snapchat, new forms of hip.
Did you ever produce a Vine video?
Damn it, producer Daryl, why didn't you ever tell me about that? I don't know.
It's a dead platform.
It's a dead platform, Sherrod. Anyway, so please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Save big at Banana Republic Factory with 60% off the entire store. Our biggest sale of the year. Plus, take an extra 50% off clearance. Stock up on dresses, shirts, and shorts under $15. Find your nearest store or shop online only at Banana Republic Factory.